here's the thing. For all of us, this is the remedial class. And we shouldn't fall into the trap of comparing our insides to what we see of other people's outsides. And we shouldn't fall into the trap of imagining what is true and problematic about us to ourselves is a permanent, unchanging, fixed, essential nature. So I wanted to, before we get to the koan, I wanted to share some stuff with you about my practices of failing. And part of why I am sharing this is because I am aware that when people look at my outsides, including the outsides of my words, they don't see this. So when I first got ordained, it was the most emotionally excruciating session that I ever sat, and part of it was due to the fact that I could not fucking figure out how to tie my queso. And at a certain point, I came to Melissa, I think it was at their house, and she had just gotten back from receiving the official high-end instruction on how to do these things. And she and we spent like an hour of her showing me this thing. And I was just sobbing. I could not do it. I could not do it. I am slow when it comes to anything physical or spatial or with my hands. A few years ago, learned to knit. I've knit some blankets and scarves and hats, but I only know how to do one stitch. And here's the thing, though. I went for private lessons from a knitting master for like 12 hours to learn my one stitch. And now I can do my one stitch. And I enjoy that. So couldn't tie my queso, and I didn't know. I mean, is it something wrong with my strings? Is it wrong with my queso? So I've had three quesos, actually. I had two black ones and this gold one, and I can't tie any of them. And maybe it's the cords. Maybe it's the fact that we wear a AHG style queso in a Sojiji style thing with anteji, whatever. But also maybe it's me. My mom has struggled in many mental health kind of ways all her life. She's currently in a nursing home. She also has Parkinson's, and she's very not in command of stuff. And she had an item of electronics, and she dropped it and it broke. And she identified that it was because the floor was too hard. So I have to entertain the possibility that maybe the problem is not with my queso. Or Yoki. So I began my practice at Zen Mountain Monastery. I lived there for a year and a half. We did 18 sesshins a year, 12 long ones, 6 short ones. Or Yoki for... for two meals a day. And I could not make my placemat into anything other than a big kind of octagonal mess. And I would like focus. I would just really try to do it. And then, you know, between sessions, you know, I would like iron creases into those things and put like spray starch on them. And it didn't help. I could not create anything other than a freaking mess. I also concluded that obviously, manifestly, I was ill-suited for koans, because it was clear to me how much Melissa loves koans, and I freaking hated them. And plus, they were all somehow indexed in Melissa's brain, and I was like, that is never going to happen for me. And when way back when in the institutional forum that preceded Boundless Way Zen, it was called Zen Community of Boston, and then we realized we weren't in Boston. I think I was the first president of the Leadership Council. And James Ford, at a certain point, had to do an intervention in which he had me sit at the Leadership Council meeting with my hand over my mouth. The Sachin before... I became a Dharma holder and got a gold kesa. It was like the morning, so we were gold kesa and gold raksu. This is the morning, and on the morning of the last day of sesshin, and so I was wearing my robes as those of us who have robes do on that morning. And I was like, okay, so this is the last time I'm going to be making these bows with a black kesa. I'm going to go in there to James. I'm going to go in there to David and Melissa. And I'm going to just bow the hell out of this bow. I'm going to bow the hell out of it. Went in there, made my bow, went down, elevated my hands, lifting the Buddha's feet above my ears gently, put them back down, stood up on the back hem of my robe and toppled over backwards. That was with David. Then I went to see James and I did it again. I'm going to also, so when I was working with James, he was moving me along on koans. He was encouraging me to start sitting groups and give talks, and I would go in, and he was very encouraging of me, which clearly indicated he didn't know the fucked up shit inside my head. And so for a long time, I would go in there and I would really try to get him to understand. I need you to know what a big mess I am. And he wasn't that interested. I have a note here on my little note of things that I want to talk about. And the thing that the little reminder cue here is, it says douchebag. And here's what that refers to. It refers to me. And yesterday when Paul shared that comment about looking up at the stars and seeing how insignificant he was, and in that moment really clarifying his bodhisattva vow that he wants to be good, heard that and I was thinking, God, I'm a douchebag. That kind of goodness doesn't come naturally to me at all. being able to sit and listen to people, be with people and meet them in counseling and doksan, just doesn't actually come naturally to me. One of my other life manifestations is as a Dharma book editor. I used to get my papers back from my professors in college, and in big red letters across the front of them, it would say, "Proofread!" And here's the thing. Here's the thing. Our weaknesses are our strengths. And our strengths are our weaknesses. And so don't imagine that your insides, don't imagine you can accurately compare your insides to other people's outsides. And don't imagine that if the way that the problematic way you are now is unchanging in nature. Although we don't become somebody else, still the same old me, but also different. This is the remedial class. This is a room full of people who are the outliers in their families of origin. Room full of people who are each the black sheep, or like the llama among the and I had no idea what I was going to talk about in this talk. And so I was sitting with just a lot of kind of angsty grief about that. But I've sat with angsty grief so much in preparation for talks that there's a way that I'm able to appreciate, okay, so this is that thing that happens to me. I'm familiar with this. Maybe, and I've noticed that sometimes that angsty grief precedes a very good talk. But I have to be open to the possibility that maybe this time it will in fact be the terrible, terrible talk. Might be. And one of the things that I was struggling with is kind of the second half of the story that goes along with our koan. The one that Liz suggested an alternative to, that rather than, how about not grieving, but what about when there's grief, grief kills the monk. To go along with Dangshan's, when there's heat, heat kills the monk. Heat particularly kills me, by the way. I get insane inside my little brain with heat. So I want to read this koan, including with the agitating second half, and then we'll go from there. I may add some commentary. Dangshan was unwell. A monk who so valued his teacher's teaching, a monk who benefited so much from the Dharma, a monk who really loved the Dharma, said, "So, I see you're sick. There's someone who's not sick too, right? There's something about this fear that I feel, and there's something about this dying that you are going through. There's something about that that's okay, right? Dongshan says, "There he is." And the monk says, "And so does the okayness ameliorate the sickness? Does the okayness care for you?" Dongshan said, No. Actually, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to care for this dying body. I am really grateful for the opportunity to care for this dying world." "Oh," the monk said. "When you do that, how is it?" And Dongshan said, "And I'm not so certain there's a problem." And later, Dongshan said to his monks who were just in a tizzy about the old Roshi's imminent death, and how would they keep practicing the Dharma that they love and that they know is so important, but that they know they haven't mastered? And how will they go on, and who will lead them? And Dongshan said to the monks, he said, "When you leave the skin bag you inhabit, where will you go to see me again?" So this me may die, but what about when you die? What about when your skin bag dies? How will you practice Dharma then? This skin bag dying is just birth and death. Your skin bag dying is just birth and death. Our ancestor Robert Aitken says, "When someone close to me dies, I vow together with all beings to settle into ultimate closeness and continue our dialogue there." That's what Robert Aitken said to try to care for his monks, for us. But that's not what Dongshan said. Dongshan noticed his monks were still anxious, freaked out, certain that there was a big loss coming. And so he did the best that he could in that moment. He grieved for his monks and tried to offer them the Dharma. He was old, he was sick, he was dying. He was maybe not at the top of his Dongshan game. And so, grieving for his monks and offering the Dharma not at the top of his game, he said, "Students are numerous as the sands, as the Ganges, but none are awakened. They err in searching for the path in another person's mouth. If you wish to forget them and not leave any traces, wholeheartedly strive to walk towards emptiness." I think what he meant to say (Laughter) was, this birth and death is the life of Buddha. If you try to exclude it, you will lose the life of Buddha. If you try to cling to it in me or in you, trying to remain in it, you will also lose the life of Buddha. And what remains will just be the shape, the mere form of Buddha. Only when you don't dislike this ocean of birth and death, when you don't pick and choose one portion of birth and death or long for it, then you enter Buddha's mind. Dongshan then had his attendants help him shave his head, bathe, and get dressed. He had the bell rung to summon the monks so that he could bid them farewell. He appeared to have passed away, and the monks began wailing piteously without let up. And so Dongshan, who was only mostly dead, took a breath, pulled himself together, and tried to continue caring for his monks. And he said, homeless monks aren't attached to things. That is their true, authentic practice. There's no need to lament an arduous life or a painful death. Dongshan decided to stick around for another 7 days to try to continue to offer Dharma to these grieving beings, continuing to offer it from his sick, old, dying knot top of his Dongshan gang. Dongshan said, let's have a delusion banquet together. I think delusion banquet would be a good name for Sashin. And the monk's adoration for Dongshan was unending. 7 days later, the food was prepared. Dongshan had a final meal with the congregation. He said, don't make a big deal about it. When I pass away, don't go carrying on about it. And what I think he meant to say is like wishing for more color or more brightness when viewing flowers or the moon. Spring has the tone of spring, and autumn has the scene of autumn. Life has the tone of life, and death has the scene of death. There is no escaping it. So when you want spring or autumn to be different from what it is, notice that it can only be as it is. Or when you want to keep spring or autumn or life as it is, reflect that it has no unchanging nature. there is something really, really essential, critical, important about honoring the reality of the specific mess of ourself, the specific mess of this dying world. There is, and it isn't a problem to see this. There is a rightness to seeing this. There is a honorability to grieving when it's time to grieve, to grieving at what is sad, to feeling pain with the dying. There is a honorability and a rightness to hurting when it's time to hurt. We don't need to keep it away. We don't need to manufacture it. But when it's here, we don't need to keep it away. And touching, being continually reminded of the pain of being, the pain of our society, the pain of our dying planet, reminds us to really care, to really be here. Reminds us that this life matters. This moment matters. This inward turning towards grief and receiving it in kindness matters. This little bit of good that in all of our insignificance we may yet be possible, capable to do. This matters. The first few days of our Sesshin were quite intense. And perhaps now we're moving into a different phase. Maybe it's quieter. Maybe it's more less cosmic in theme and more something else. But don't imagine that what was before was, don't imagine it was bad. Don't imagine it was good. And what's here now, don't imagine this is bad. And don't imagine this is good. Don't imagine that pain and grief and sadness and loss and despair and inadequacy and failure is bad. To be worked through, processed so you can get to the good stuff. All of that is also the good stuff. So, moving into our Dharma dialogue, sitting as suits you, coming forth as spring and autumn.
been a lot of talk about dying on this retreat. And my father died on July 4th, so I was there with him for much of the end. And I remember it in a way, felt like a sashim to me. Going in and being with him as he was going through this remarkable process. He appeared to disintegrate bit by bit before me, which I might have thought of as a terrifying, terrible thing, just like I anticipate with terror coming to retreat. And he was in his own retreat. I remember at one point, as we were eating together, he looked at me and he said, "I'm so, so confused. So confused." He really did not know in the deepest way. And that was all. just that very clear presentation. A little bit later, he was sitting back on his chair, and he just said, "Well, this is the way it is." And that, to me, was a gift beyond measure, to hear my father offer that teaching. He died a few days later. And last night I had a dream where I came upon my son, and he was dead. And he had stopped breathing. He had, something had blocked his airway, and he had stopped breathing. He was, it was clear to me that it was over, that he was gone. And I was just taking it in. I said, "My God, he's dead." And then I walked up to him and I said, "Well, who knows?" And I tilted his head back and he started to breathe. And he looked at me and he told me a story. And I guess I'm grateful that we have the chance to breathe.
Thank you, Mike.
Excuse me, Mike, could you speak up? I can't hear you from here. There's a fan right next to us.
You were talking about your relationship with Orville James and how you kept trying to convince James that it was something completely messed up, that he shouldn't be having so much faith in you. I was wondering, is he like playing that with me when I go in and talk to him? And I've been thinking a lot about Wayne asked a question, maybe it was the first day, about what's the value of this practice. And for me, that is exactly the value of this practice, is that I still feel like I'm completely messed up, inadequate kind of guy, and I keep showing up here, and everybody keeps expecting me to do stuff. And even when I mess up, they still say, "Well, just keep doing it." And it's really been valuable to have a place where I can come and check in with that once in a while, so that maybe I'll decide to retreat off the cushion. Maybe I can step more off the ground.
Thank you, Mike.
Josh, I really appreciated your giving us the landscape of your individual mess. And because actually when I was bowing and I stood up, I accidentally stepped on my robe and heard this ominous ring. So I have no idea what's happening. But But I wanted to say that, you know, that you're trying to convince James, okay, that you're really a mess and you shouldn't teach. Sort of reminded me that as much as we want to believe that somebody else isn't a mess inside, and because it's such a longing we have to find somebody who's not, that the reality is that we all teach each other from our place of mess every moment. I mean, Mike, your dad taught from his place of mess in his last moments. And that the more we become intimate with our messes, the more we can teach each other. And that's what you just really embodied, and I'm very grateful.
Some of you have heard me mention my favorite New Yorker cartoon, which is a couple of down on their luck looking people standing on a street corner, and one of them says to the other, "And then I realized failure is an option." and James's relentless and totally ill-advised faith in me really helped me see that his faith in me, despite the way the content of my little consciousness, right, it really helped me find the faith and be able to truly entrust my heart to it, to this Dharma that is not about how it's going for me right now in the content of my little mind. And the reason I'm so clear about that is because the content of my mind is such a mess all the time. And this has been the place where I have done, lo, these many decades of practice. And if it were dependent on the content of my consciousness or on my excellence in being able to do something, both of those are changeable and will fade and are unreliable sources of refuge. Thank you, Bob. Okay.
Josh, that in knitting there are only two stitches. So in 12 hours you mastered 50%. The point being that we really can't ever see the whole picture, right? We judge ourselves from some limited point of view. And it's never accurate.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you for your teaching. Christine.
That was very funny. Thank you. I am so profoundly grateful that you shared so honestly. And I am so profoundly grateful to show up here who I am and the mess I am without trying to make it different for myself, which is a game I played inside myself and outward. And it feels so safe here. And what I'm learning as I guess I'm just going to use this word, as I embrace my messes, I'm also finding the lotus. And I spent a lifetime looking for it outside because I believed it can't possibly be here because of my messes. I mean, and now it feels different and I'm not sure I can articulate it. Mm-hmm. And I just want to end by saying, back to Haiti, finding the joy in all the pain.
Let's not go back to Haiti, okay. Kristen. Yeah, let's stay here.
Okay, so I feel so much. Oh, gosh, I guess I do that when I'm feeling deeply. Huh? Not to hate you, but...
I think that everybody has their own version of Haiti. Yeah, somewhere we go to when it's really so similar to what James was saying. When we, it's very hard to bear this joy that's beyond simple happiness, and so we immediately run to Haiti. You know, get in the boat and go row as fast as we can. I think that's really important to articulate, and I'm grateful to you for it, Christine, and also to look in our own hearts. You know, every one of us could tell a story like Josh, but it would have different deficiencies. You know, when we hear somebody talk about their so-called deficiency, we think, that's nothing. You should be inside my skin bag. Jeez Louise. And really, they're all equal. The hot messes of the, what is it, Diane, what did he say, the skin, the
smelly
the smelly red flesh in the skin,
smelly skin bag.
Yeah, the smelly skin bag. Yeah, it's like, that's pretty right on. And
well, and I think one way to look at Dongshan's final words, you know, don't mourn for me, nothing is born or dies. And so we talk so much about entering through the particular and through sadness, through the grief, and absolutely wonderful. And we also talk about the sadness and the grief come and go, and the intimacy that's possible in this moment. And so maybe Dongshan, his last gift to his monks is not to imagine that some light outside them has died. That still here, the Dharma you seek, as Christine said, is not somewhere else, is not sitting in the front of the room, is not in the person you'll be after three more retreats.
You know? What? Right?
So this one here and now. So a wonderful... You know, this middle way, so we can get lost in our stories that someone else has it and has now left us. And so this wonderful statement of nothing is going or coming, dance and be joyful.
Hi.
Thank you, Josh. Mike, I really like what you said. It really struck me, and I appreciate you sharing. I also have had death come near me recently. I lost a cousin in June, and I returned from that funeral, and a young friend passed away. I hadn't seen her in a while, by her own hand. So, and what I was struck by, and you had said, Mike, you know, that there seems to be a lot of talk of death, and I've probably not thought so much about death since I've started doing Zen, because we talk about it every time. And even then, my cousin, I hadn't spoken to in many, many years. This friend, I didn't know her that well, but, you know, we, our paths didn't cross again. And I forgot. I forgot that, yes, people die. And it can happen at any time to anybody, and that's just sort of what your father said, so that's the way it is. Is that how we pray? But you had said something I thought was very powerful, was that it was his own retreat or he was on. And I took that as the word retreat, like to receive, to pull away, and the well and unwell. You know, I looked forward to this sesshin because I needed to get well. My brain was all crazy. But while I'm here, I'm not really sure that's what's happening. The difference between your father or anyone who passes away, or anyone regarded as a retreat and receiving, is that at least for us on this retreat, we return. Well to unwell, unwell to well. I'm not sure which is what.
Yeah.
So I really value that you're sharing that and expressing that as a retreat, using that word in that way, because I don't think of this as a sort of like what David had said, he's an electrician, that, you know, I'm going to go on a retreat with 40 people, that's going to be a big silence. I just tell people I'm not off on some Zen training, because I don't want to go into that. It's not nice that you think.
Thank you. You know, Harry, as you're speaking, and actually this whole Dharma dialogue, this has been coming up for me, I keep flashing back to Dongshan's words, you know, don't make a big fuss, don't make such a big deal out of it, which we've played with in so many ways, and the reinterpretation through Dogen's words that Josh gave us, really, you know, don't ask for more than there is. How about that? Don't ask for... There's also something... When death hits us personally, it's really a big deal. It feels like a big deal. This person, you know, like, think of my parents' deaths, close friends, these people in your life, Mike's father, I mean, every single person in this room, you know that old story about the Buddha, find a mustard seed in the home of someone who's never experienced death. Well, big surprise, couldn't find a mustard seed. Every single moment when we breathe in and we breathe out, at least one person, if not more, is dying right at that moment. They're taking their last breath out, aren't they? And so to make a big deal of it would, in a sense, dishonor it, right? It individualizes it and it makes it small. It's the human condition, and Zen is partly, if not all, about dying to the self now, because we're going to do it eventually. Why not now? And then we can live in a different way. That's quite an offer. And you've all taken it, even if you don't think you have, because you're here. Nobody so far has run screaming out the door. We did have that happen once. I can't remember. But anyway. So to honor it and not make a big deal of it is not to dishonor the grief we feel.
I'm picking up on this thread, Mike and Harry and Melissa. I'm reminded of the Zen poet. I'm pretty sure it was Zen poet Gary Snyder, who, when he was in hospice dying, people kept saying to him, "You have to process your death." And he said, "I am the process."
I think it might have been somebody else, because I think Gary Snyder's still alive.
It could be. I think it might be Ihsan Dorsey.
Yeah, so it was Ihsan Dorsey, definitely.
If it was Gary Snyder, did a great job.
Well, he's just like Dongshan. He came back and he's had years of delusion banquet. But he calls him writing poetry. But Ihsan Dorsey, yeah, I think that's right. That's right. Great, a guy who had AIDS and started the first Zen hospice, was one of the first open transgender Zen teachers in the whole wide world. Amazing guy.
Going off of that track in some ways, but back to the idea of having such fixed ideas about who we are and what our messes are. I just had an interesting little moment of a different facet or flavor of that in my own life here as I was going through the doorway into the kitchen the other day. I mean, one of my stories has been that I am not a kind and compassionate person. And you've heard me give comments and talks. I've talked about how I had some idea in mind about what compassion was that I was very sure that I did not have. But someone was coming out, and I bowed and I stood aside. And then the words and the tone were very different that came to me. The tone was delight. The words were, boy, am I a phony. Because I don't think of myself as a kind of person who bows and stands aside and the rest of this. But there was some kind of playfulness about that. I mean, real person, phony. To say something phony, there has to be a real. And give that up. Somebody bowed. So when I run right into you next time, that's the
right. Somebody didn't bow.